Greetings. Welcome to In Conversation with Trevor, brought to you by Heart and Soul Broadcasting Services. I go beyond the headlines and beyond the sensational. Today I'm in conversation with Victor Mapunga, the founder and chief executive officer of Shona Prince and Flexi ID Technologies. If you enjoy this conversation, remember to subscribe, to like, and to share. Let's get down to some work. Victor Mapunga, welcome to In Conversation with Trevor.
It's an honor to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Since the last time we met at the Ideas Festival, October, November last year, we've been wanting to do this, and finally you are here. But before we start, Victor, allow me to share with our viewers our statistics at the moment. We're sitting on 9.1 million views on YouTube alone. We are on 61,400 subscribers. Very excited by that. We're inviting you to press the subscribe button and join our amazing community of viewers. And so also go to the notification button, which will alert you every time we have one of these amazing conversations. And so also like and share. So that's what we are asking from you. Victor, you've just come back from the US.
Yes.
Fundraising. This is something that you've been doing since you were 23 years old.
Correct.
So tell me about this latest trip to the States. You're just back. How did it go?
Yeah. So over the past 8 months, I've been working on a new company, which is called Shona Prince Technologies. So it's in the connectivity space. We currently define our company as a stealth startup, meaning that we're not yet publicly marketing our products as we're actually building out the technology that we want to roll out. So, I mean, it was a very fruitful, successful, and insightful trip. Whenever a founder or a startup founder is doing fundraising, it's probably the most challenging part of the whole journey, next to actually executing the idea itself. Because that is one of the most foundational processes that a startup founder has to be able to do. If you can't fundraise, your startup is never going to get the fuel to take it to the destination that it needs to go. So for me, it was really just getting back in the ring. The last time I did it was 2 years ago in 2022. I was going around the world just pitching to raise funding for my startup Flex ID. And it's not easy. It's not easy at all. The failure rate is around 90%.
Let's go. Let me just stop you there and say, so what's, you say it's not easy. Mm. It's tough. You're just saying right now the failure rate is high. What is it that the people that are watching us out there ought to do, those that are in this space, for them to be successful? You've done it before. You're doing it again, which means you've learned a number of lessons. Share with us the lessons of successful capital raising.
I would say the first thing is you really need to have a thick skin because disappointment is going to be coming on a daily basis. So for every one yes you get, you're going to get 99 no's. So for reference, I once sent emails to over 400 venture capitalists. And out of 400 venture capitalists, only 30 responded. And out of the 30 that responded, only 10 actually took a meeting. And out of the 10 that took a meeting, only 2 decided to commit to some kind of investment. So, for you to get rejected by hundreds and hundreds of people consistently, for most people, that could be, very disappointing. So you need to have a thick skin because it is going to happen, but it's part of the game, right? For you to be able, whether it's Ronaldo or Messi, for them to be able to score, they had to train a lot. And most of those times, they would miss until they actually figured out how best to kick the ball. So I like to look at founders as some kind of athletes, but economic athletes, if you will. And you have to train very hard for it. The second aspect of it is really being able to articulate the problem that you're trying to solve and what value it's able to create in the market. So the difference between a startup and a typical SME business is that startups do not seek to just extract value. They seek to create value and then be able to extract it.
Right.
So it's very critical that when you are pitching your business and you have an idea you're putting to the ground, that you're able to carefully articulate the value creation part of it, because that is really what gives incentive to potential investors and even customers and consumers who are going to take upon your product.
Mm-hmm.
So those two things are very critical. And I'll say the last thing is just have good relationships with people. Most of the individuals that have come to help me in my path or invest in my companies, it was a result of consistently networking with people, maintaining communication, maintaining contact, and just having genuine relationships.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd find that the current investors I work with today, we met over 2 years ago, and we never lost touch. And they didn't invest in my company back then. But because of consistent communication, because you're consistently being genuine with individuals, you're able to actually build a lot more trust, which is extremely critical if somebody is going to part ways with capital for what could be a failure. So it's very important that in your day-to-day life that you maintain those relationships. You're very genuine, you're very honest and transparent, regardless of whatever is happening.
So Shona Prince Technologies, you say it's stealth right now.
Yes.
It's not yet out there. You've got a piece of technology that you're working on. You've got a value that you want to create. FlexiID, you've already fundraised for FlexiID Technologies. And you say out of how many? 400?
400.
400. Yes. 30 showed an interest. 10 took a meeting. 2 met. Finally, indicated an interest to invest. Did any of those 2 invest?
Yes.
They did.
So they did invest. And I'm very grateful for, you know, all the individuals that have, you know, trusted me. Because when I look at what the role of a founder is you're actually a steward of capital. And to be a steward of something means that somebody has bestowed some level of trust and responsibility in you. And that's a very big task. It's not simple. It's not easy. Most individuals assume capital is personal money that you can use to solve your personal problems. But that's not the case. You've been given an extreme privilege that most people in the world will never have access to. This is not a bank loan whereby you're required to pay it back with interest. This is a risk that somebody's taking. There is a possibility of failure that it might not happen. So you must take it with the responsibility that it needs you to have. So, you know, they did invest in the company. We built out great technology. Last year, we implemented a solution in Sri Lanka, you know, with, you know, one of my then partners who was based over there. And, you know, we managed to
condolences. He passed on, hey?
Yes.
My condolences. Yeah.
Yeah, unfortunately. And, you know, we had worked very well together for the past few years. You know, one of the very first people who actually encouraged me to set up an offshore company. So I set up my first offshore company in Singapore. I think I was 22 years at the time. And, you know, I didn't think it was possible at the time to be able to do that. So I started really learning about international markets that, you know, when you're actually a founder in the 21st century, don't think of yourself as a local Zimbabwean founder. You're a global entrepreneur now. There are now tools which can take you from zero to, you know, to 100, just like that. And I'm very grateful. I learned that skill, and I've since set up multiple companies in different countries, Rwanda, Mozambique, South Africa, the US. And again, I now just see myself as, you know, being able to take something that I can build in Zimbabwe and I can bring it to other markets which might appreciate it.
Let's talk about FlexiID Technologies. What solution have you come up with? What problems are you trying to solve?
Yeah, so for me, it's a very personal thing. So what happened is I came back. I spent some time in the U.S. Between 2016, 2017, 2018, 2019, and I came back to Zimbabwe in 2019. And back then I was just getting my life together. I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do. All I knew is I wanted to build value. I wanted to build something, but I didn't know what it was. So one of the first things you do when you're an adult is you register a bank account. That's one of the very first things you do. So in my mind, my very naive mind, I thought, this process might take me 30 minutes to an hour to do. So I went to my local bank, with the documents I thought were appropriate, grabbed an application form. And halfway through it, I realized I can't finish this thing in one day. The requirements for me to open an account were just too exhaustive. They're too much. I needed to bring in my proof of residence. I needed to bring in all this documentation. And I was unemployed. I was staying in my mother's house. So even the proof of residence wouldn't have my name on it. You just had all these hoops. So I found that to be interesting. And I just started speaking to people in the bank branch, just other people like, how long is it taking you to open an account? And one gentleman, was like, I've been trying to register an account for a month now. And he stays in some rural area where, they don't even have documentation to prove that they stay at this particular village. And I took that, I was offended by that, this is the 21st century. How can it be so hard to do something as simple as, just getting access to finance, to an account? So I spent the next few months just thinking about it, meditating on it, talking to a few people until one day, the company just materialized. And it materialized after I spoke to an ex, schoolmate of mine who was now based in Canada. And we said, can we actually build some kind of technology to solve this? And at the time, there's this new technology called blockchain. That was all the rave. And we said, we think this technology would be ideal to solve this problem. And really what we ended up creating is a digital identity wallet, which allows you to keep all your credentials. So your identification, your proof of residences, your transcripts, your health records, your financial statements, your credit scores. Why? Because once you have this digital identity, you now have mobility. And this mobility allows you to access, financial services. It should be one click to open an account. If you have a bank account with one bank, you should be able to transfer that information to Bank X, and they should be able to open an account. If you went to see this one doctor, you should be able to transfer your health records from Doctor 1, and you should be able to go to Doctor 2. And you'd be surprised, even up to now, in some developed countries, it's still very hard to share medical information, to share your past academic transcripts. Imagine a Zimbabwean who studied at Lotito High School trying to apply to university in Switzerland. They don't even know whether or not your result transcript is correct because they have no way of verifying. So you find Africans lose opportunities globally because nobody trusts what we present. So what we're really building is infrastructure for trust. How do you trust what an African individual presents, what an African business presents? If you're applying for capital at the IFC, if you're going to the World Bank, how do they know that the information you're presenting is accurate? So that's what Flex ID aims to do in a nutshell.
How is it done so far?
So in the beginning, it was very hard, extremely difficult. And part of the difficulty was how I was pitching the solution. So I was coming from a background whereby I could easily speak to my colleagues about the technology and we could all understand what we're doing. I come to Zimbabwe, I go to some boardrooms with a few banks, and the moment I say blockchain, they say Bitcoin. they say,
sorry, I have to laugh.
They say, you are the Bitcoin boys.
You're cryptocurrency.
You are those Bitcoin boys. And I'm like, no. When it's completely different. Yes, Bitcoin is built on the blockchain, but this is foundational technology. This is infrastructure. So I had to go through almost 8 to 12 months where I would really just be educating people, lecturing them, showing them the differences. And I mean, these are some of the challenges that happen when you're building in an emerging market. That if you're building something which is almost a leapfrog, which jumps from, you know, 1 to 100, you know, you have to fill in the gaps. So that was a very big challenge in the beginning. The second challenge was the technology itself globally was just not ready.
Mm.
So, you know, apart from a few countries in the world, you know, maybe Singapore, the UAE, and parts of Canada, very few countries had this digital ID. And I think Estonia was the leading country in the world, and they built theirs in the late 90s, early 2000s. And India was now also rolling out their own technology. And these were public sector funded initiatives. So imagine a startup that has raised $0 based in Zimbabwe with all the wonderful things going on in Zimbabwe. And it's trying to really solve a problem that ought to be solved by the public sector.
Mm.
So that was such a Herculean task. And really, it was naivete that, you know, made me think I can do it. And I think you really need to be a bit naive and almost, you know, a bit unrealistic as
crazy.
A founder to pursue things like that.
Mm.
And it's challenging because you start to realize that there are all these hurdles you need to cross.
Mm.
So that was a second challenge, which was just, you know, which was just
out of this world.
Out of this world. And the last challenge, obviously, is the financial part of it. You know, I had to figure out what business model, you know, I was going to use, how I was going to charge for this thing, what revenue model. You know, how are we going to make money? And lastly, combining those things, how are we going to present a case to raise investment? So I spent, you know, 2019 just talking to people, nothing. 2020, again, talking to people, and it was very tough. And I had to figure out how to, you know, make money on the side in order to keep that dream alive until we eventually were able to successfully, you know, raise investment.
Wow. Exciting stuff. You are only 26 years old.
Yes.
You have been the first Zimbabwean entrepreneur to be inaugurated in the into the World Economic Forum's Technology Pioneers in Davos. As we were starting, I say to you, the things that you've done are huge for a 26-year-old. Mm. We're going to take a short break here. At home, don't go away. When we come back, we're going to drill into what keeps Victor going. So see you on the other side.
This country has some of the best entrepreneurs. This country has visionaries. And I realized that if I wasn't going to do it, nobody else was going to do it.
Welcome back to our conversation with Victor Mapunga, the founder and CEO of Shona Prince Technologies and Flexi ID. When we took a break, Victor, I was just sharing that you are the first Zimbabwean entrepreneur to be placed on the World Economic Forum's Technology Pioneers in Davos, 100, and you made that list. I think you made that list at 24 or thereabouts.
Yes.
You just highlighted to us the fact that it's tough being a startup entrepreneur. You need to have a thick skin. You need to be ready to be disappointed 99% of the time. How do you survive at this young age that level of rejection, that level of disappointment? I get the sense that it's very lonely.
Yes.
Talk to me about that.
Yeah, so this journey is mentally, emotionally, and spiritually draining. And really, the first thing I would say is I thank my parents, you know, for the foundation that they created for me. So my late father, he was an entrepreneur, and, you know, I watched him build a business from the ground up. I watched him build an institution from nothing. And I also watched those challenges. Something my parents emphasized, which I think most parents really should do, is they were extremely transparent with their children about their financial circumstance, about the performance of the business, about what was going on in their lives. They never sugarcoated anything. So I knew when my dad didn't have money. I knew when school fees was going to be paid late. It didn't come to me as a surprise, as a shock. I had to prepare for those circumstances. And I believe with time, you know, what began to happen with me is I began to also accept that, you know, if you are convinced about doing something, it's going to come with challenges, but those challenges do not mean the end of you. You're still going to wake up tomorrow. You know, you're still going to need to eat, bath, and you're going to have to do it over and over again. So I think, you know, that foundation for me was, you know, extremely critical to being able to do that.
Just share with us what your father, Dr. Mapunga, what he was into.
Yeah, so yeah. My dad, you know, is originally from Chipinge. You know, we come from Manicaland. And he moved to Mutare just before I was born. And back then, he was a sales rep for Power Sales. Mm-hmm. And he used to sell records at Power Sales. And he was an entrepreneur from, you know, from day one. He really didn't want to remain in the job. So, you know, he quit, you know, even though he had a family to support. He had three children at the time. And he decided to sell sugar from the boot of his car. So he was just, you know, selling sugar just like that. Until one day he said, I'm going to build a wholesale business and actually push massive volumes off this. And he managed to convince, you know, the guys in Triangle and Chiredzi to say, you know, guys, you know, trust me with this. Give me a few trucks and, you know, see how I do. And, you know, he didn't even have a warehouse. And, you know, somehow he managed to convince these guys to deliver this. And yeah, from that, you know, he started with one truck, two,
so there's
five,
a lot
ten.
Of him in you.
Yes.
Tell me, how do you, so they've laid the foundation for you, but tell me about how you actually walk through that place of disappointment, that place of emotional strain, that place of psychological loneliness. How do you pace yourself there?
The truth is, the first time I left Zimbabwe and actually went abroad, I realized just how far behind our country was. And I realized that for any society to actually make it, there must be people that actually take the responsibility of building it. And when I was there, I was not impressed by the skyscrapers for me to want to stay there for the rest of my life. I said, I want this for my people. I want this for myself. I want someone to come to Zimbabwe and say, this country, it has order. This country has some of the best entrepreneurs. This country has visionaries. And I realized that if I wasn't going to do it, nobody else was going to do it. And I guess, you know, in some cases, it, you know, it sounds somewhat, you know, individualistic. But for me, I feel I have an obligation and responsibility because I was privileged enough to be exposed to what could be, to what must be. So whenever I face a challenge, you know, whether, you know, it's an investor who says no, it's a customer who declines to take our product, or it's any other challenge in business that you face, I always remember that I have to do this. For me, there is no going back. There's no plan B. I do not believe in, you know, in...
plan B and C.
In plan B and C. You got to make it work. You have to make it work. And sometimes you fail, but failure is not fatal. You know, failure is not permanent. Mm. You can, you know, pick yourself up, dust yourself up, and again, try again tomorrow, and try again tomorrow. I think for me, it has helped me. It's been, there are days I really did feel that, you know, my life isn't going anywhere. There are days I've questioned my own decisions to say, you know, you could have just stayed in a much more developed country.
What keeps you going when you are experiencing those days when you feel your life is not going anywhere or you feel you're not being successful? What keeps you going there?
I think about how I started. I think about some of the very first days when I moved to Harare for the first time, because I grew up in Mutare. And I remember telling my mom and my brother and my sister that I'm going to Harare. They said, to do what? Where are you going to live? And I said, I will make a plan. I didn't have a plan, Trevor. I had no customer, no income, no money, nothing, zero. And I said, I'll make a plan. I'll make it work. And I moved here. I had
plan A.
That was it just came. I just came here, and you know, I had this blue Honda Fit that I used to drive back then, and I would go park by the Bronte Hotel in the avenues under shade. There's a tree which gave me some shade for some time, and I would sit there and I would just start thinking the whole time. So what am I gonna do now that I'm here? And, you know, there's this thing called serendipity, Trevor, which we, you know, just underestimate. And serendipity, some people would want to call it luck, but, you know, it's a combination of preparation and also just motivation. And I would just talk to people. I would dress up. You know, I'm sure you know, I normally never wear suits.
But today you are in a suit. I'm like, blown away.
But back then, you know, I would try to take myself seriously. I would then, you know, wear formal and all that and go to offices. And I remember this one time I went by the Reserve Bank of Zimbabwe. And, you know, I just walked in. I didn't have an appointment or anything. And, you know, I did, you know, that was my first time there, but I just walked in. I said, you know, what's the worst that could happen? Let me see who I can speak to. And I said, look, I want to speak to someone here who understands fintech and everything. I said, who do you want to talk to? I said, exactly what I said. And then they brought in some guy. He came downstairs to the lobby to meet me. And I spent about 30, 45 minutes just talking to him. And, you know, it didn't go anywhere. But, you know, he gave me some very good information, which, you know, allowed me to do the next thing and the next thing and the next thing. Until eventually I had my footing on the ground. I had a place to work from. I now had a roof over my head. I had a community around me, some other startup founders that I was now talking to. And slowly, but almost overnight, I had a community. And my business also started to have traction. So I really am a believer in just doing things. I'm a doer.
Let's go to your education. So you started at Hillcrest Prep. Talk to us through that that space. So Hillcrest Prep, and then what did you do?
Yeah, so for my primary, I went to Hillcrest Prep. It was a very,
this is in Mutare.
This is in Mutare. Very great school, beautiful. You know, just outside of Mutare, you know, everything is green. The scenery is amazing. I had great teachers. The environment was extremely conducive, kind of allowed me to just, you know, think about what I wanted to do with my life. And from Form 1 to, you know, my upper six, I went to Hillcrest College, which is now the high school. And I think my entrepreneurial journey really began there. So I was always interested in technology. So from Form 1, Form 2, I started teaching myself how to code, right? I wanted to know to make computer programs, to make software. So I would go on the internet, I would go in the cafe, you know, the school computer lab, you know, download just, you know, gigabytes and gigabytes of books and videos on how to write programs. And, you know, during my spare time, that's what I did.
Where did this interest come from? Wanting to write programs, wanting to code?
Yeah, for me, it's, I thought to myself, what is the best way that I can create something that another person can use? And for me, I found beauty in technology and I found beauty in software because there were zero restrictions. All that was required is your mind to say, I want to build, you know, this website where my classmates can go and do revisions. And, you know, for the people that were, you know, there used to be a website called, you know, it was Extreme Papers or X Papers, where people just go and download all these bootlegged, you know,
exam papers.
Exam papers. And I wanted to build something similar, but that was the rave back then. I wanted to just build something where I could just put content and people could start downloading. So the very first thing I ever built was called iLearn FB. Mm-hmm. And basically, I would take, you know, all the textbooks, look at the chapter, summarize them, create PowerPoints, create videos, and I would upload them there. And, you know, I started having a few users here and there, a few people in Zimbabwe. And the day that made me extremely happy is I went on my dashboard and I saw about 100 people from Pakistan had gone on my website, and about 50 from India. And I said, wait, this thing is actually a thing. It, you know, like, you know, someone can actually...
I've created a thing that people are interested in.
I've created a thing that people are interested in. But I didn't know how to make money. I didn't know, you know, what was, you know, that this was actually something which is called a startup eventually. I was having fun. Mm. And I believe for me, that was the whole point. It was me having fun with a hobby and saying, you know, I want this hobby to eventually just become every day for me. Mm. This is the career I want, to just do things like this.
And then you didn't go to university.
Yeah.
Why?
So in my lower sixth year, I got accepted to this program at Yale University in the U.S., you know, massive Ivy League college, and they had selected about 200 students in the whole world, and I was one of maybe six Africans who were part of that program. So the first time I laid, you know, foot on that campus, I mean, it was glorious.
What was this program called at Yale?
Yeah, so it was called YYGS. Mm-hmm. So it was Yale Young Global Scholars Program. And it was under the technology, innovation, and entrepreneurship sector. And, you know, I got on campus and I saw 199 other people like me, except they were from different countries, different races, ethnicities. They were coming from Thailand. They were coming from Mexico. They were coming from Sudan. You know, they were coming from all over the world. And it was like just this one big place where I found, you know, most people like me. Mm-hmm. But something then struck me when I was there. I said, this institution and institutions like this, the reason they've created these programs is such that when you learn what they're teaching, and it was a massive crash course in, you know, in business, in tech, and entrepreneurship. Very difficult. We had to wake up very early to go for these lectures.
How long was it? Sorry.
Yeah, so I spent a month there.
Yeah.
And it was just extremely painful, because on a daily basis, you were just bombarded with content every single day. And when I came back to Zimbabwe, I said, I would like to do that again. So then the year after that, I got accepted into a program at MIT, which is Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and it was much longer. I stayed the summer.
The Massachusetts Institute of Technology.
Yes.
The MIT.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I stayed a summer there. And, you know, a summer, which is, you know, our winter time. So basically I missed, you know, second term of school, which, you know, some people really didn't like. But I said, no, I need to, you know, get more and more skills. And that program was even much more practical. We actually had to create a startup within a short period of time. And I had three other colleagues of mine, you know, that I was working with to create this startup. And in the end, we actually had to do a public pitch. You know, we were going around Boston, you know, talking to potential customers, saying, hey, you know, we're trying to build this thing. You know, and I learned sort of how Americans, you know, build companies and build startups. And for me, it was the fact that, you know, you had economies that trust young people with this kind of responsibility. And some of the guys that would come speak to us, most of them were university dropouts. And they would say, look, guys, if you want to do something, just do it. Don't wait.
You also went to King's College. Was that soon after MIT?
Yes. Mm-hmm. So soon after, I got on a flight to London, and I went to King's College. And I was staying in Westminster, and the program there was called ESPR, And, you know, it was funded by some Silicon Valley guys, very technical, programming, artificial intelligence, you know, blockchain, which is where I actually learned a lot about blockchain. And it was very hard. I felt I had imposter syndrome because now I was with people with who had master's degrees from Princeton, PhDs. They didn't discriminate which level of academia you were at. So it was, you know, people who just finished high school to people who were doing their PhDs at some of the most elite universities. And we would all attend these classes together. And I remember one of the lecturers there, you know, she had a one-on-one with me. And she said, "Victor, how do you feel?" And I said, "I feel out of place." And she said, "Why?" And I said, "Well, I don't feel qualified to be here." And she said, "Do you think we're crazy to have accepted you here?" And I said, "No." She said, "Why do you then feel you're not qualified?" You are qualified to be here, which is why we brought you here. And, you know, I felt some kind of way. I felt that even though I thought I was young and I still needed to go through this journey, there was validation and validity in, you know, what people saw in me. And after that, I came back home and I said to myself, I want to build something. I want to build.
Did you finish your A-levels?
I did. I did finish my A-levels. But during
What did you do at A's?
So I was doing maths, physics, and computer science.
Yeah.
You know, for me, that was just my passion. But, you know, my, you know, A-level years were tough. You know, my father passed away in my lower sixth year, a few months before I went to Yale. And, you know, that was also a very tough time for me, trying to, you know, balance, you know, my school with how I was feeling. I was introverted.
I'm sure.
So I really didn't talk about it much during that time or with anybody really. So I was kind of just going through this, this phase.
This pain.
And, you know, it wasn't easy. It was tough. Even when I was going abroad and all that, I was in the back of my mind that's something that I was also battling and also facing.
Mm.
So,
have you dealt with that?
Yes.
You have?
Yeah, very much.
Mm.
And I think, you know, dealing with it for me came from actually doing
stuff.
And, you know, they say time heals. And truly it does.
Mm.
With time, you get to appreciate, you know, the fragility of life, how short it is, but also how beautiful it is.
Mm.
And when you start to look back, it's not looking back with pain and grief anymore. It's looking back, you know, with acceptance and with also just this feeling of saying, you know,
gratitude.
It's gratitude. Like, I'm grateful for the time that I spent, you know, with my dad. I'm grateful for the time that I spent with other people in my life who have come and gone. And, you know, I couldn't have it, you know, any other way.
Mm.
Yeah, it was necessary for me to go through that.
Mm. We're going to take a break here. When we come back, we're going to go to stuff that I know you're passionate about, how to create the ideal ecosystem for startups, the challenges that you've experienced, and the lessons that those challenges present for us to be able to build an ecosystem that supports startups. And also you are passionate about wealth creation and a culture of saving and investment. So don't go away. When we come back, we'll delve into those very heavily lifting issues. See you on the other side.
Business which is incorporated in Zimbabwe faces a lot of restrictions when it comes to accessing other markets, accessing capital, accessing financial services.
Welcome back to our conversation with Victor Mapunga, the founder and CEO of Shona Prince Technologies and FlexiID Technologies. So, Victor, you operate from a number of centers. Just tell us where you operate from, where your technology business operates from.
Yeah, so FlexiID is incorporated in Singapore. And, you know, Shona Prince is incorporated in Rwanda, in Mozambique, and very soon Zambia and Malawi.
Mm-hmm. What's the thinking behind that?
So if you want your business, so startups are different from traditional businesses in the sense that they must scale. And when we talk about scale, it's the ability for your business to reach as many potential consumers and stakeholders as possible. Now, one of the limiting factors that could limit your startup from growing is where you are incorporated. So unfortunately, Zimbabwe has not been the most disciplined of jurisdictions in terms of doing business. Mm. So what it means is that a business which is incorporated in Zimbabwe faces a lot of restrictions when it comes to accessing other markets, accessing capital, accessing financial services. It is very hard. Anyone who has worked in the fintech space or in finance can actually tell you that it is extremely difficult even to move money when you are based here. So if you want to absolve yourself of that, if you want to make your business be able to operate in places where it must, it is advisable to have offshore incorporation. Mm. I cannot stress that enough. I had to part ways with about $5,000 when I was registering the company. And at the time, I remember I had gotten a contract and I got paid $10,000. And I took $5,000 and I had some other obligations. I was left with zero after 3 days. and I said, you know what? It's going to pay off. Mm. And indeed, it paid off because the very first investors that put money in the company were also based in Singapore. And it made the whole due diligence process much smoother. It made it easier to talk to investors because they said, we acknowledge you are a Zimbabwean founder. Working to solve an African and a global problem, but it does not mean your business must be restricted by geography. Mm. You see, that is the beauty of the modern capitalist economy. Mm. You can be based here in Harare. You can live here in Harare, but you can have something running, 10,000 miles away in a completely different part of the world.
In Rwanda, Singapore, the USA, in Mozambique.
Yes, South Africa. Yes. So, and Zimbabwe.
And Zimbabwe. Let's talk about Zimbabwe. We're going to play the clip where you are speaking at the Ideas Festival, and you're very critical about the ecosystem in Zimbabwe as it relates to supporting the startups. Let's have a quick listen to that.
We do not have an ecosystem because by definition, I think the word ecosystem originally came from biology.
Yeah.
And what they meant by that is if you look at the biodiversity on the planet, everything feeds into each other. Mm. It works in perfect harmony, right? When you have a farm and you kill the snakes on your farm, you're going to have an infestation of rats.
Yeah.
So it is that ecosystem whereby all these different players contribute to the overall outcome. So when we talk about the startup ecosystem, what are we saying? We're saying a startup plays an integral role in the economy that ensures we're able to leapfrog. There is no need to host a lot of conferences where we talk about the fourth industrial revolution. But our corporates are not going to be the ones to do that. You know, Delta is not going to do fourth industrial revolution. We have to be honest about this stuff. It is going to be a startup that is going to discover something either in artificial intelligence, either in biotech, either in blockchain, either in crypto, and they're going to be the ones to take us forward. In 2017, Zimbabwe had an amazing opportunity to be the leader in blockchain and crypto. But unfortunately, at that time, we had individuals that decided to actually, to kill a baby before it actually grew. And what it meant is we lost out on a $1 trillion opportunity. venture capital is agnostic
to your heart. That breaks my heart right there. I hope it breaks your heart, guys. Yeah.
And today we're talking about artificial intelligence, and we're being left out once again. Why? Because as Ryan was saying, Victor is going to approach organization A. This is my company. Organization A is going to have executives who are going to say, you know what, we might as well just do this by ourselves. That's a problem. Why is it the hottest fintech product in Zimbabwe right now was created by guys who sell deep-fried chicken? Inbox is a product of people who sell chicken. How could it not have materialized from bankers? It's people who sell us chicken and chips that are disrupting how we send money across the country. Something is wrong. It means that we have people sleeping on the wheel when they are really supposed to be saying, guys, how do we ensure that we allow different players into our industry? There are multiple examples, inexhaustible examples that we could give across all industries, from logistics to healthcare.
Do you still hold those views that you're so passionate about at the Ideas Festival, that there isn't an ecosystem that's conducive for startups in Zimbabwe? And what ideally should we have that would support ecosystems?
Yeah, so I still hold those views, Trevor. I think it would be unfair for me and unfair to other entrepreneurs who are operating in this space to sugarcoat the scale of this problem. Startups in Zimbabwe are facing infanticide, which is basically a genocide of infants.
Mm.
And I say they're infants because they are not even being given the opportunity to become toddlers, to actually grow and eventually become adults who compete in the global market. You go to any part of the world, you see multiple international brands. But when you travel to the US, to Europe, to wherever, to Dubai, you seldom ever see a Zimbabwean brand. You do not even feel a level of pride as a Zimbabwean to say, this is one of our companies dominating in a different market. It's something that we should be patriotic about, to say, you know, we need to champion the creation of companies and industries that go to dominate other markets. When a South Korean flies to Zimbabwe and they see people on their Samsungs, they feel a sense of pride.
Of course.
This is who we are. When a Japanese comes and they see all these Toyotas, they feel a sense of pride.
So what do we need to do as a nation, as a people, to ensure that our economy, our capital markets, if any, do support businesses such as yours?
I would say there are three things
that
we need to take very seriously in Zimbabwe. The first thing is we need to learn to respect intellectual property. Startups, for the most part, what gives them value is intellectual property. Our businesses and our public sector must respect IP.
Mm-hmm.
If we do not respect IP, it means we do not have companies that are investable.
Mm.
Intellectual property is as important as property rights.
Mm.
If someone can just come to your house and say, this is now my house, if someone can come to your mine and say, this is now my mine, it makes the market extremely risky.
Mm.
When you look at tech startups, intellectual property is all we have.
Mm.
We don't have physical assets, Trevor. You know, we don't have mines and machinery.
We don't have land.
We don't have land. Mm. It's IP.
But that IP is hugely valuable.
It's extremely valuable. Yeah. So if I go to a bank, a telco company, or a government parastatal, and they say, we want to implement this solution, only for that institution...
to steal your IP.
To subcontract some Indian company or some Ukrainian,
Russian company.
To reproduce
what you...
to reproduce that, that creates a problem. If you look at how much some of our institutions are paying foreign vendors, Trevor, it is beyond ridiculous. Zimbabwe is paying hundreds of millions of dollars annually to foreign companies to do what a local company is able to do with a team of maybe 5 to 6 really good software developers. And, you know, we are not giving our own young people the opportunities to build their own Microsofts, to build their own Amazons, to build their own Visas.
Mm.
Because, you know, we have this inferiority complex to say,
What can a Zimbabwean do?
What can a Zimbabwean do?
Particularly 26-year-old Victor.
Yes. I mean, look at who's printing our passports, Trevor.
Mm.
You know, the number plates on our cars are not even made here. number plates.
Something as simple as that.
They're not made here. And, you know, we overlook these things, but that is capital which is leaving this country on an annual basis. Mm. That is capital which could be going to companies locally that could then be serving.
So that's the first issue. IP, you said three issues. Yes. Which one is the second issue?
The second issue, Trevor, is we actually need to have policymakers who actually are incentivized to do their job well. The biggest problem we have in Zimbabwe is our policymakers have the wrong incentives. Because to be a policymaker in Zimbabwe, to occupy a particular position, unfortunately, we have not gone the route of meritocracy.
Mm.
So when you have a society that lacks meritocracy, you have a society where essentially for you to be able to climb the ladder, you don't need to really do your job well. You just need to say the right things, associate with the right people, be at the right place, right time. And it means that you do not look at the end result. So that is a big problem. Zimbabwe does not have a startup bill, which actually categorizes startups and creates incentives for companies. Mm. We should be having individuals in parliament, in cabinet, that are advocating for the creation of, you know, startup ecosystem zones where startups do not need to pay any tax. Mm. It is much easier for a Russian mining company to get a tax break in Zimbabwe than for a Zimbabwean entrepreneur to get a tax break to create a
startup.
That
breaks my heart. But that's the reality, isn't it? That's the truth.
That is the reality. So you face that this environment becomes extremely hostile to its own people.
To young people particularly.
To young people particularly.
With a huge potential to create jobs.
Correct.
So as a startup, supposing you have been brave enough and you're victor, you've started this thing, what is it that you require for you to feel supported from the political side, from the policy side, from economic incentive, financial incentive? Can we talk about that package? And I understand Nigeria has done this very well. Yes. Maybe reference to that would help us realize that this is actually doable.
Yeah. Outside, the first thing is Zimbabwe needs to have a comprehensive startup bill and policy, which puts startups in a preferential status. That means that startups in Zimbabwe, if you come back to Zimbabwe from the diaspora, for example, you finished university, you finished college, and you say, I'm coming back to build Zimbabwe, we should be able to allow you to create your company like what they do in Rwanda within one day.
Mm-hmm.
It should not take you 2 to 3 weeks to register a company. Our financial institutions need to make it easier for startup businesses to open bank accounts, again, within at least 24 to 48 hours. We need a tax system, a tax regime, which is not punitive, but which is supportive. You should be able to get a tax holiday for at least 3 to 5 years whilst you're still building your startup. I mean, this needs to happen as soon as yesterday. The third thing is our public sector must be made to adopt solutions which are made locally. There should not be any ministry in this country, any state-owned enterprise in this company, which is buying software from Belarus, which is buying software from Dubai. The first thing that must happen is we must say, do we not have our own companies locally which are able to do this? That should be the first thing. We should mandate that. To say it must be mandatory. Mm-hmm. It's only when we fail should we look for outside help.
Mm-hmm.
And when we do look for outside help, we must pay that expert and a local company such that they are able to have skill transfer.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely critical.
Mm-hmm.
The third thing is on talent. Zimbabwe has some of the most talented individuals operating outside of Zimbabwe. We need to incentivize these people to come back home. We need to incentivize these people to bring the solutions that they have home. But the first thing that they'll always ask is, am I going to get remunerated as much as I'm being remunerated here? Am I also going to get respected as I'm getting respected over here? So what are we saying? We need to give our most talented and smartest individuals particular privileges when they come back to offer their skills. And a simple solution is to just say, if you come back to Zimbabwe and you want to set up a business, we're not going to charge you any of these, you know, ridiculous taxations that we give you.
Taxes at every turn.
At every turn. Everybody's getting taxed out of their pockets, out of their minds. You know, that really needs to change. And I'll say lastly, at more of an executive level, let's allow young people to have dialogue which is honest without them having to fear they'll be punished for it. You know, at the end of the day, it's also psychological.
Of course.
You cannot operate in an environment where you're constantly watching over your shoulder. You're constantly looking at, you know, who might, you know, be following you.
Yeah, and who am I offending?
And who am I offending? Because this is our country. We all want Zimbabwe to prosper. The way things are now, that is not happening. The FDI and investment coming into this country is extremely low. It's embarrassingly low.
What examples do we have on the continent? I did mention Nigeria, where they are doing this better than we're doing.
Yeah. Nigeria have a startup bill, and Nigeria is, you know, per capita, the most funded African country, even more so than South Africa. Rwanda has done this perfectly well. So Rwanda has what they call the RDB, the Rwanda Development Board. And when I actually registered Shona Prince in Rwanda, they said, you can register your company in 4 hours. And wow. I said, nah, you guys are lying. 4 hours to register a company. And they said, try us. So I did. I registered the company, submitted all the documents. Within 4 hours, I had my incorporation papers. And I said, this is wild. And then I said, you know what? If you want to do anything in Rwanda, there is nobody who is unavailable. You want to speak to the central bank governor? He's available. You want to speak to the minister? She's available.
For the right reasons. For the right things. Yeah.
You know, and it attracts competence. It attracts competent people. You know, there is no corruption, you know, which is a key thing that we must understand. Corruption benefits incumbents. It does not benefit those who want to come and also play. So you do not want to create an environment where you must pay to play. You want an environment where for you to play the game, all you need to do is be competent and be able to actually deliver what you promised them. So Rwanda has done this well. Kenya has also become a significant giant in the startup space. So you find, you know, most of the unicorns. A unicorn is a startup that is valued at $1 billion or more. Nigeria has created at least 3 unicorns. South Africa has about 2 to 3 themselves. Egypt has a couple. Kenya now has a couple of unicorns as well. And these are companies worth over $1 billion. And they were built within the past 5 to 7 years by young people who wanted to change their countries. So we must not be afraid of creating a subclass of new industrialists who, you know, are not allegiant to any sort of particular political leaning. People that become successful because they've delivered value, not because they were able to extract value or, you know, to win some very questionable public procurement tenders.
So tell me, what makes you hopeful about this country? What excites you about Zimbabwe?
It's young people. The most abundant natural resource we have in Zimbabwe is not diamonds, platinum, lithium, gold or oil. It's this. It is the minds of young people. The human brain is the most sophisticated, you know, piece of infrastructure that we have seen in the universe to date. It is the most sophisticated because it can take a thought, a simple thought, and turn it into a physical thing that somebody is able to touch and use. Everything that you have in your house, the car you drive, it started as a thought. Somebody thought about it. And then they said, let me work on it and it can become something. Zimbabwe has a mean age of about 19, meaning that about half of this country are people who are about 19 years of age or less. And for me, that is a massive demographic dividend that we must capitalize on. instead of watching young people go down the path of drug abuse, young people go down the path of destitution because of unemployment, we must say, how do we use these people? We must use the young people here. We must not just watch them. They must be used.
Absolutely.
Because they have minds, they have brains.
Create opportunities.
We must create opportunities and say, you guys, this is your country. This is your country. These are your roads. These are going to be your power plants. These are going to be your farms. These are going to be your banks. This is your stock exchange. How many young people in Zimbabwe are even aware that you can build a company and list it on a stock exchange? They believe these are things of business legends that have since passed, or you know, guys that did things in the 90s and early 2000s. When was the last time we had a Zimbabwean entrepreneur build a company and list it on the stock market and generate value? So the young people in this country, I'm hopeful that they can do that.
The other opportunity that's on our side is the fact that you've got these young people that you've absolutely rightly identified, and you've got new emerging technologies that these young people understand. Talk to me about that. You know, the opportunities around artificial intelligence, Bitcoin in medicine and so forth, combining that with the young brains that we have. Talk to me about that.
Yeah, I mean, I get very excited about this. So if you are in high school or in college right now, I'm sure you're using ChatGPT on a daily basis or any other large language model, which they're called. AI is going to revolutionize not just Africa, but it's revolutionizing the world. Now, here is a business opportunity, Trevor, that even our government can implement. And I'll say this for free. Artificial intelligence is going to replace white-collar jobs in Western countries. So people who are working in the legal space, people who are working in accounting, in finance, even software developers, AI is now able to generate code. And what is the one thing Western countries love is to reduce cost of doing business. Zimbabwe can create a center where we empower our young people to use AI to give remote opportunities to companies abroad. And we can do this at a cost-effective manner. In Zimbabwe, if you have a salary of about $1,000 a month, we consider you to be middle class.
Yeah, you're doing well.
You're doing well. But in New York, $1,000 cannot even give you a one-bed apartment. But there is a company in Texas, in Houston, there's a company which is in Australia, which is more than happy to pay you $2,000 a month for you to sit on your computer and use AI to just summarize their documentation, to do work for them remotely. And we now have the technology. We have the coming in of Starlink, which is going to revolutionize connectivity across all of Africa, meaning that even if you're in Lotito, you now have the same internet speed as somebody who's in Dubai. I mean, just saying that, people are not understanding how revolutionary
that
is.
That's huge.
That is absolutely huge. Blockchain technology and cryptocurrencies have been so misunderstood. One of the biggest costs in the world, Trevor, is the cost of moving money around. It costs an arm and a leg to move money around. Ask anybody who sends money back home. You can send $1 billion, and this was done.
In Bitcoin.
In Bitcoin, and the cost of that was just $34 to send $1 billion. Imagine the opportunities we can create by creating legislation which supports these innovations instead of seeing them as threats. The era of banks, Trevor, unfortunately,
is gone.
Is gone. You know, the person is the bank. The phone is the bank. And these technologies are going to allow everybody to become an industry upon themselves. So if you are a young person, and by young person, you know, I mean, is if you feel you still have the energy, even if you're 45, you know, and you feel, you know, I still have the energy to do something, look into these technologies and how they can change things. Schools are going to change, Trevor. We no longer need to, you know, invest, you know, hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars in building this infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
we're going to go to books, eh?
Yes.
I mean, you and I could go on and on. But I knew you were coming here, so I thought, let me look smart and come up with that. Books that are interesting.
Yeah.
So one book that I've recommended before that I've read and would love to recommend to people is a book by George Gilder called The Life After Google. This is absolutely exciting. It's about the stuff that you're talking about right now, the fall of big data and the rise of the blockchain economy, which is the space that you're in right now. I'll recommend that book.
Yeah.
And secondly, please, I have been suggesting this book on all my platforms. And by the way, we've created the Trevor Book Club. We've got a WhatsApp group for that, and it's really going amazingly. Invite you to join that group. I think we are now oversubscribed, but, you know, try. One person or two might have exited. This is a book called The Coming Wave, AI, Power, and the 21st Century's Greatest Dilemma. Fascinating book. In terms of making our policymakers understand what AI can do.
Yes.
I mean, for me, any leader who's serious about going into the future, leading into the future, you need to understand this book. You need to try and get hold of this book. You read a lot. I know you and I love this book.
Yes.
0 to 1 by Peter Thiel. Mm. What books have you? I know you've read quite a number of books.
Yeah.
Would you want to recommend to our book-loving audience?
Yeah. So for me, when I look at the impact of a book, Trevor, it's a book which changed my way of thinking mm-hmm. in my day-to-day life.
Yeah.
So 0 to 1 by Peter Thiel was one of the very first books I read, you know, when I went to the U.S. You know, they recommended it. I bought it, and I ferociously read it. And, you know, for me, I fell in love with it. It became my startup Bible of sorts. And it starts really from the first chapter itself, right, to say you now need to look at how do we build tomorrow.
Yeah.
And, you know, the concept of just building a startup and how you take it global, mm-hmm. you know, Thiel, he's able to break it down in a very easy manner,
absolutely.
Non-technical.
Yeah.
Anybody can get it. It inspired me a lot. The second book I would recommend is a book called Freakonomics
mm-hmm.
by Stephen Levitt. Now, Freakonomics is a very interesting book because it talks about incentive structures. And when you start to understand incentive structures, you start to understand almost any problem we have in our society. They look at statistics from a point of view that traditionally we never thought of.
Right.
They have a chapter in there called Why Do Drug Dealers Still Stay With Their Moms? And they went and they did this research and found out that some of the top drug dealers in the metro cities in the U.S. actually are people with bachelor's degrees.
Mm.
You know, they're people who went to university. They did business. Some even have MBAs. But they are moving millions of dollars of drugs and they still stay with their moms. And, you know, they asked them, why don't you have a big mansion? And they said, well, you cannot control the turf and have the trust of the people of the community if you are somewhere living in Beverly Hills, far away from the action. You gotta be in Compton. You gotta be showing communities. If one of your foot soldiers gets shot and killed, you gotta be able to go to the mom.
That's
and,
the ecosystem,
that's
isn't
the
it?
Ecosystem.
Yeah.
And you know they figured out that you know if you scale it up, it's applying everywhere. You know, the entire world operates like that. You know, Freakonomics for me was absolutely
mind-blowing. I've had recommendations to read Freakonomics, but nobody has broken it down the way you have.
Yeah.
So I'm going to go and look for it. The third book?
It's called Black Swan.
Aha.
Yes, by Nassim Taleb. Now, that book is, you know, one of my all-time favorites. Now, the Black Swan...
Can I just make a confession?
Yeah.
I've backed reading Black Swan. I've started, stopped, but I eventually got through it. But I don't think I got what it's all about. Share with us briefly why you like it.
In a nutshell, you know, this book is breaking down how singular events are able to have dramatic outcomes, which we call these black swan events, black swan moments. So to give you a practical example,
COVID was a black swan moment. Why was COVID a black swan moment? It was unpredictable. Nobody predicted it could have happened. And it changed the global economic system.
Big time.
It led to the adoption of cashless transactions in most parts of the world. It changed how we travel all over the world. It changed global healthcare and how we respond. The whole world changed due to something that nobody ever thought of. The coming of the internet was a black swan event. The smartphone was a black swan event. And all these events changed the trajectory of society in a manner that, you know, nobody ever thought of. Mm-hmm. So the point of the book is to help you be able to identify when events are moving towards sort of this black swan singularity.
Disruption of some sort.
It's very hard. Even in politics, it applies, right? There are certain events that could happen that could just trigger a complete change. You know, the Arab Spring is a good example. It was a black swan event. You know, Gaddafi did not see that coming.
No.
And it completely changed. And you could argue and say Facebook was the black swan event which led to the Arab Spring.
Mm.
Because Facebook was used. Recently in Kenya, we have seen a lot of protests. And the platform that was used by the Gen Z in Kenya is TikTok. So nobody in Kenya ever thought TikTok could one day be used to mobilize the masses without a leader. A leaderless
revolution
powered purely by technology.
Mm.
So the Black Swan, if you read it, I mean, it's a dense book.
It is.
It's very dense. You need to give it time. Mm. And I would say you need to read it multiple times.
I need to go back again.
but it changed how I see things. So in my day-to-day life, even when I do business, the reason why I'm in tech and I do what I do is because I must be able to recognize when something is changing and say, guys, let's stop what we're doing. It's over. AI is one of those things.
Mm.
In the next five years,
AI is huge.
You will not need armies of developers, Trevor. Mm. You really just need 2 to 3 guys.
Absolutely.
And they have the power of artificial intelligence.
It's massive. It's massive. Wow. Victor, what an opportunity. What a pleasure talking to you. You are 26 years old. I mean, I still can't wrap my mind around that. Your future is amazing. You've just shared with me being in America and the Americans being as non-believing, as impressed by your age and what you're doing.
Yes.
The things that you're doing are big, and we wish you the very best. And I'm hoping and wishing that maybe in another 5 to 10 years we'll sit here and look at what Shona Prince Technologies and FlexiID have done. I'm sure you're going to be building more things. We wish you all the very best as you are. Capital raise, your vision is huge. So we wish you all the very best. Thank you for creating the time for the conversation. Thank you so much.
No, thank you, Trevor. Thank you for having me. And thank you for viewers, for giving me the privilege to share my story with you. I'm excited for this platform and for the future.
Fantastic. Allow me now to turn to our viewers, Victor, who are all over the world. Thank you so much for your support. Remember, we are a weekly show. We are out every Monday on YouTube at 7 a.m. Central African time. To ensure that you don't miss out on any of these quality conversations, remember to subscribe, to like, and to share, but also to click on the notification button so that you don't miss out anytime we have one of those quality conversations. Engage with our amazing community in the discussions below in terms of who should be on the show and your comments. We read those comments and we love them. Thank you so much for your support. Until next time, cheers to you all.